as we mentioned before, the criminal acts of Carlos Rafael have had a negative ripple effect on New Bedford's economy, groundfish fishermen, and shoreside businesses. And even before Rafael, there was tension with scientists and regulators on one hand and fishermen on the other. So economist Ann Georgiana, I just want to go back to you. How do we ultimately prevent another Carlos Rafael?
Well, I think the central problem, and I'll speak a little bit, but I'm not, Carlos is gone. Carlos Rafael is gone, and I think we have to look forward to what we do without him. But I think the central problem was that he could buy fish as well as he buy fish for his business as well as sell fish. Scalpers can do that all the time, and there's no problem with that. But I think in this case, it was a system that was flawed. I think that the oversight didn't really react quickly enough. The system of NOAA that regulates the catch, I don't think reacted quickly enough. I don't think the sector reacted quickly enough, and the sector changed its board of directors when we realized what was going on. So we have new board of directors, and we've put in place a system where all the fish that's landed is sold on the auction. So in other words, it can't be off-landed, and we've set up a system of captains who report what the catch is while they're still at sea, which they're supposed to do anyway, but it's not very well enforced, I don't think. So I think a better enforcement of the rules we have would help. There's some question, you know, Carlos Rafael didn't just buy vessels, right? People sold vessels. And people sold vessels because they couldn't make a go of it. And they couldn't make a go of it because of the problems with ground fishing. So I think it's a system that leads to consolidation. And it's always been the case. Catch share systems always lead to consolidation. And consolidation is a problem in fisheries. I don't think it's even very efficient, quite frankly, because fisheries require all kinds of size boats that can fish all these little nooks and crannies. And instead, we have a system that I think that encourages consolidation. And there's attempts to try to stop that, but I don't think they've been very successful either. But there's an argument that consolidation came about because of the catch share system, as it always does.
And John Quinn, chairman of the New England Fishery Management Council, what innovations or new ideas are out there that might help fish and fishermen, whether it be like nets, I don't know, designed to let more cod through or changes in assessment?
Yeah, as I said earlier, you know, especially through this RSA program, there's a lot of research being done up and down the East Coast on gear reconfigurations, a whole host of things. I know, as I said, SMAST and Division of Marine Fisheries are very active in that. I know on the groundfish side, SMAST is doing a video camera survey of the cod population, and I know the state DMF is involved in that as well. Also involved in a herring avoidance program that DMF is involved in, so there's a lot of activity around that, hopefully to make the gear more efficient, to let the smaller fish out, and to try and reduce the bycatch. There's a lot going on. More can be done, though.
And Laura Foley Ramston, you're the owner of a family business called Foley Fish that sells fresh seafood to specialty retailers, and your business has been around for more than 100 years. And so what can be done to make sure there's still room for small businesses in the fishing industry, kind of with larger companies kind of consolidating different areas of the industry, owning things such as boats and marine supply companies and being fish dealers? What can you do to kind of make sure there's still room for small businesses?
Well, now you know what keeps me up at night, wondering those things. So we traveled to the West Coast a few years ago in Oregon, where they had catch shares, and a friend's parent said, gosh, Laura, you get fresh seafood every day. We can't get it because everything has been consolidated offshore in these frozen at sea boats. And that's really, you know, a tremendous fear of mine, not just for Foley Fish. And yes, we've been around since 1906, 111 12 years now, in four generations of Foley's in seafood. And, you know, what we are sort of passionate and militant about is making room on the menus for New England seafood. And that's what I talked about in the beginning. I would love for everyone in, you know, Kansas and Chicago and Detroit and Texas and Georgia, you know, inland areas to be experiencing fresh, local, all-natural New England fish. So how do we make sure that we keep the fish coming through the port and that we keep processors in business, that we keep people wanting to go out to sea? We fishermen keep fishing. Those are all questions that I have. But what makes me believe that we will be here through another generation is that anytime anyone experiences a piece of fish from New England, they want more. It really is a truly special, delicious product, no matter what it is. You know, a clam, an oyster, a mussel, a scallop, a cod, a haddock, a monk, a hake. So I do believe there is a market for it. We just have to make sure that we have management in place that makes it readily available on a 52-week-a-year basis. We've got to take the highs and the lows of management out. When I was there, it was the sky is falling about cod, and we were making 80% cuts. And then I read last week that, oh, just kidding, we're up 156% on one stock of cod and 97% on another stock of cod. And I thought, wow, well, we made everyone feel like they couldn't eat a piece of cod in good conscience, and now we have triple-digit increases in the quotas. So what can we do to even out management? What can we do to make this resource in a responsible manner more readily available? I think that's how we keep shoreside businesses, fishermen, auctions, restaurants all going into the next generation.
And Cassie Canastro, Marketing Director of Base New England, did you have anything to add about how, like, what can be done to make sure that there's still room for small businesses in this fishing environment?
Exactly what you said about family-owned businesses, I think, obviously. Yeah, me too. I think it's important that it's the management, because why would you want to join the groundfish fishery if you know it's going under? There's no, if you know that a fleet of boats can be shut down at the drop of a hat, you know what I mean? Why would you want to join that, knowing that that could happen at any given time? We can't find fishermen to go groundfish fishing because there's no money in it. There's no money in it anymore. If you're young, you're going scalloping because there's money in scalloping. So I think it's about, you know, a balance in management to make it appealing for people to want to join the industry. So that's my thoughts on that.
Yeah, economist Dan Georgiano.
I'd like to comment as well. I was appointed by Governor Patrick to the Commission on Seafood Marketing for the state of Massachusetts, and we made a bunch of recommendations, and I think that's going forward. Many states market seafood. Alaska is a famous example. New York markets seafood. I think there's just the beginning of brand names for fishery products, which I think would help. And there's a way to look at barcodes to figure out where the fish came from, which I think would also help. There's a lot of suspicion among consumers that those things work, so we have to overcome that kind of mistrust. But I think there's some beginning signs of brand names and better quality. Scallops are very high quality. I was impressed the way scallops are marketed. I thought when they started bringing in very large scallops, they'd never be able to sell them. Within 2 years, they were selling them for much higher prices than the other size scallops. I mean, they figured out. So if you look at any seafood, any cooking show, not any cooking show, but I don't look at that many of them, but they often have scallops. Scallops are this perfect food. Right, they're easy to cook, they're easy to produce, they're now frozen individually, there's a whole set of new products, and that's what's really necessary. But that can only happen if there's enough landed. There's a critical mass that has to be landed to allow that kind of marketing. Doesn't pay if you have nothing to sell. So there has to be a sufficient amount of product that comes into the port or comes into the system that encourages seafood processors to market the product, right? It makes sort of sense. And scallops have that. Groundfish do not have that.
Kathy Canastro, with New Bedford's electronic seafood auction.
To what Dan said about marketing Massachusetts seafood, I think a big issue with that is that we're marketing the wrong products. I kind of touched on this before, but we're so focused on dogfish, and we've got tons of haddock that can be landed and utilized, and I feel like that's, and then we talked about barcodes and things like that, and the auction's working to develop a new software that's going to offer that to our customers and our processors to ensure that what is being landed and what they are buying is truly the same thing. So I think that's going to be important for a lot of grocery stores. I think over the years they've gone away from New Bedford seafood because they're not sure about it, they're iffy about it, but if we can guarantee that what they're buying is what is landed and it says the vessel name and the date it was landed, I think that's appealing to a lot of large grocery store chains, and they need to commit to buying haddock and large quantities of haddock. And if they have that interest and they want to buy it and we can supply it, you'll see some changes in prices and you'll see fishermen wanting to go catch haddock again.
One other comment.
Economist Dan Georgiana.
The fishermen at the moment have a hard time catching haddock because they have to worry about what they're not supposed to catch. So we catch, it used to be 5% of the quota. I think it's probably more now. It's probably more like 10%. But that's infinitesimal, I mean, given the large haddock stocks that are out there. So it's hard to catch them because they have to worry about what they're not supposed to catch. And that has to be fixed. That system has to be fixed.
I would just add, yeah. I did pull the numbers, catch, and, you know, the haddock stock is divided into multiple parts, but Georgia's Bank Haddock East, we caught 0.7% of the stock, 0.7. So to your point, we need to enable the fishermen to catch what we've allocated.
And slightly shifting gears, I wanted to kind of talk about climate change. We're seeing the effects of it now, kind of with rising sea levels in New England and warmer ocean waters causing lobsters to move more up north. And John Quinn, chairman of the New England Fishery Management Council, what is the council doing right now to keep fisheries sustainable?
You got a couple hours? I mean, it's probably not the question to ask framing the climate change debate. I think, generally speaking, as you indicated, species that used to be caught in the South Atlantic are now up in the Mid-Atlantic, and Mid-Atlantic species are up in the New England area. We're fortunate at the New England, the Northeast Science Center, we have an expert in climate change, Dr. John Hare, who's the newly appointed head of that, and we're very fortunate that he'll be working on that. I know they're putting a lot of resources into it. You know, we've been talking for an hour about assessments and stocks and ring size. This is the 600-pound gorilla that if we manage and conserve and the fish are just disappearing because there's nothing else we can do. I don't want to be too dire, but I think it's we can't do much about climate change. We can't manage climate change. That being said, next week I'm going to be down in Washington, D.C. for this national meeting, so the head people in New England, the Science Center, the Mid-Atlantic, and the South Atlantic, we're going to get together and talk about how, from a governance level, we can try and address this. If you are catching a fish in New England that you don't have a permit for, because it's permitted in the Mid-Atlantic or the South Atlantic, it's probably illegal to land it. So all these simple ABCs of management and landing and ownership issues also were factored into the climate change. So very complex, no easy answer. There's a long way to go on it.
Yeah, economist Dan Georgiana.
I don't know the exact number. It's more than 90% of fisheries in the U.S. are sustainable. I mean, I think there's an idea that all the fish are gone and, you know, the fisheries are not sustainable. But the vast majority of species managed within the U.S. are sustainable and a lot have been certified sustainable. That's another whole story. But NOAA does a report every year. And so most of the fisheries, the vast majority of fisheries in the U.S. are sustainable. I mean, there's lots of little problems. You know, groundfish is a big problem. But I don't want to leave people the idea that fisheries are unsustainable or we're wiping out species or there's no more fish left. My sister eats fish in California. She says, see, there's no more fish left. I say, what do you see in the supermarket? You know, I mean, there's a sort of a misconnect in terms of what's going on with fisheries in the U.S. I mean, we are sustainable. right? And we're pushing sustainability. The whole system does that. And I think it's been pretty successful at it.
Laura Foley Ramsden, owner of Foley Fish.
So we do a three-day Foley School of Fish seminar, and we have chefs come in, and they've been reading all the wallet cards and the rating cards, and these cards want to paint the whole ocean red, yellow, and green, and we try to explain that it's not that simple and that these fishing, these species are in individual fishing grounds, and you really need to understand how they're being managed. But most importantly, you need to know that overfishing is illegal in the United States of America. So people throw around these terms like non-sustainable and overfished and depleted, and very much to what Dan is saying is it's illegal to overfish in the United States of America. And we have some of the strictest fishery management rules in the world. And actually, in New England, our biomass is growing. It might not be the stocks that we all want to see growing, but our biomass is growing because of the fishery management measures that have been put in place when the stocks crashed in 1993-94 when the Sustainable Fisheries Act came in. So I get passionate when people start talking about New England fisheries as non-sustainable or overfished. And unfortunately, in fishery management, the best thing that we can say about a species is it's not overfished. How do you like that for a double negative? So we can't say it's abundant, it's viable. We just have to say it's not overfished. So we sort of, again, have this negativity surrounding fisheries and harvest of fisheries that it would be great if we could eliminate, because we do work really hard and we are at the forefront in the United States of fishery management. And every single catch limit that is set for every species here in New England has a triple buffer in place. So they take an overfishing limit, the maximum sustainable yield, an acceptable biological catch, and then under all of that, they set a catch limit. And we're still underfishing that by 77%. I can do the math. 77% under that triple bumper is what we're taking out of the ocean. So please don't feel guilty eating New England fish. We are a sustainable resource.
Great. And we're out of time. I really wanted to end on a positive note. If anybody has anything pressing that they wanted to say, just in a few sentences really quickly, kind of what is the most promising thing that you see for the Port of New Bedford and what would help get it there? John Quinn,
Chairman. I will give you three quick answers to that. One, we've got tremendous infrastructure. People from all around New England, up and down the East Coast, are getting their boats repaired in New Bedford Harbor, buying their gear. I actually deliver gear once in a while to my friend that's a fisherman in Maine. You don't realize how diverse this port is as far as the infrastructure. Number two, we've got a tremendous trained workforce. Fishing is in the blood of people from New Bedford. It's passed down through generations. We've got a workforce second to none. And third, we've got a tremendous support from the local political structure, the mayor, the Harbor Development Commission, awful lot of people, the legislative delegation are very, very supportive. Oftentimes you don't see that in other places. South Boston, where Laura has a plant, is being gentrified. Used to be a fishing port. Now it's condos. That's not happening in New Bedford. So we got a lot to, there's a lot of bright things going on in New Bedford. And last but not least, we have SMAST, one of the world-renowned fisheries research institutes, right here on our back steps. A lot to be proud of, a lot. The future looks bright for New Bedford, as the previous speaker said. You know, let's not look at all the negatives about New Bedford. There's an awful lot of positives here.
I'd like to thank University of Massachusetts Vice Chancellor John Hoey, College of Visual and Performing Arts Dean David Clayman, Star Store Campus Coordinator Dr. Jessica Fernandez-Gomes, and the many people in the room from UMass Dartmouth and other organizations who were so generous with their time and insight as we covered our series One Square Mile, New Bedford. I'd also like to thank our panelists, Chairman of the New England Fishery Management Council and former Massachusetts State Representative John Quinn, owner of Foley Fish, Laura Foley-Ramsden, Ramsden, Marketing Director of Base New England, Cassie Canastra, and Economist Dan Georgiana. And finally, I'd like to thank Rhode Island Public Radio's General Manager, Tori Malatia, News Director Elizabeth Harrison, Chief Engineer Aaron Reed, and Production and Operations Manager James Baumgartner. And I'm Rhode Island Public Radio's Environment Reporter, Avery Brookins. Thanks for listening.